our collective nightmare in 2026, after a second term that many hoped would be a rerun of chaos rather than escalation, the United States woke up to find it had kidnapped a foreign leader and called it policy. President Donald Trump, re-elected in 2024, ordered a strike. Maduro was taken into U.S. custody in New York, and the White House treated a coup like a press release. This was sold as law enforcement and anti-narcotics work. It smelled like oil and empire. The pitch was simple. Maduro ran a cartel state, and America had to protect itself. The reality was uglier and stupider. The same hand that promised to stop endless foreign adventures reached for the biggest stick in the neighborhood and swung it like a man who forgot what humility is. Regime change has a history. That history is a list of funerals, failed states, and the slow drip of American credibility. Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya. Each one taught a lesson the government chose to ignore. The playbook is the same. Shiny morning victory, empty years of occupation, and then a public that slowly realizes victory was just a theater trick. The new play opens in Caracas with the same props: a captured dictator, televised bravado, and a promise that the oil companies will fix everything. They always will. The constitutional questions were left in the dust. The Constitution says Congress votes on war. The administration said it was law enforcement. The Senate's usual complaints arrived after the fact, and most congressional Republicans folded into praise. When the people who should be leash holders become mouthpieces, the leash is a rumor and the dog runs free. That's governance now. A man with a handle on power who uses it until someone louder shouts. The domestic political calculus is blunt, a quick, bloodless. Operation can boost the cult and silence critics for a season. But the risk is obvious and old. Remove a strongman and what follows is not tidy. Venezuela is 28 million people with armed factions, scarcity, and a wrecked economy. Restoring an oil industry doesn't rebuild civil society. It takes troops, years, and an appetite for watching chaos unfold under an American flag. If the ouster becomes a long slog of violence and occupation, that will be Trump's bill to pay, and the bill will come due when the polls matter again. There is also a global angle that smells like a caricature of old empires. The administration's language about running the hemisphere and taking back oil sounded like a history lecture you don't want to take. Russia and China will not pretend to be surprised. They will redraft alliances around this new rule, the strong reach when they feel like it, and the rest of the world files the paperwork later. That will not make America safer. It will make the world a more dangerous place where power is the only currency left. The spectacle was capped by a press conference at Mar-a-Lago, where the rhetoric could have been written by a maniacal intern tasked with rewriting the Monroe Doctrine in bullet points. Promises of judicious transitions and the suggestion that boots could return to Venezuelan soil were offered without a plan. The only clear plan was profit. Oil companies waiting with ledgers and the promise to restore revenue. Colonialism now has a corporate partner and a campaign slogan. This is governance by impulse. It trades long-term planning for short-term headlines. It treats foreign policy like a product launch. It assumes that military power can buy stability, and that instability can be outsourced to contractors and diplomats who write optimistic memos. That experiment has failed before. It will probably fail again. Our institutions reacted in predictable ways. Democrats were outraged. Some Republicans cheered. Others shrugged and read the briefing. Public opinion was already against military action. A majority did not want this. That did not stop it. That is the news. This report is not a call to nostalgia for competence. It is an admission. The machinery that used to restrain presidential impulses is rusty and quiet. The man with the most power has decided to use it in plain sight. The rest of us are left with the familiar horror of watching history get remade without the parts that used to matter: restraint, accountability, and a real plan for what comes next. How far will he go? Who will stop him? The answers are unclear and uncomfortably simple. Probably farther than the maps foresee, and probably no one in time. The nightmare is collective because it is made by all of us, by our silence, by our applause, by the institutions that chose performance over duty. We report it, we shrug, the world adjusts, and the engines of power keep running loud and indifferent.
First world problems. We broke a travel record in 2025, 5 billion people airborne, and apparently what that unlocked was 5 billion creative new ways to be unbearable. Tourists flooded cities and islands, then acted offended when locals pushed back. In Barcelona, they brought water pistols and got sprayed back. In Kyoto and Bali, they clogged streets and then posted authentic culture shots while pretending not to notice the shouting. The modern souvenir is not a postcard anymore. It's bad manners with a caption. Americans abroad learned a new Olympic sport, flagjacking. If you're met with, "Did you vote for Trump?" your immediate defense is to become Canadian, which, to be fair, is the first honest thing any of these people have done on a trip. Influencers went full tourist audacity, parachuting into fragile places for footage. They treated warnings like Instagram filters. Taliban-hosted tours made the rounds online because nothing says travel goals like filming your gratitude to an authoritarian PR team. The thirst for content has become the new colonialism, except with more ring lights. TikTok travel hacks were peak engineering by idiots. People racing through terminals in 15 minutes, wrapping seatbelts around their ankles mid-flight, filming in-flight makeup tutorials during turbulence. The result? A new class of injured influencers and airports full of people who thought efficiency meant risking everyone's flight to save 15 minutes and one shaky selfie. Locals started charging entry to Instagram hotspots. Farmers in the Dolomites installed turnstiles to keep out the people who think a centuries-old landscape is a photo op line. If you can steal a cobblestone from Bruges or drag a 66-pound marble base between your e-scooter feet, you're not a traveler, you're a walking Etsy problem. Statues got groped, altars rifled through, and fountains leapt into like cinematic fountains of entitlement. People fondled Molly Malone and Juliet for luck, and left bronze with a bad case of human fingerprints. Art is now a tactile suggestion. When bare beating, playing music out loud without headphones, became a thing, a man in Nantes got fined $200. Meanwhile, someone took a baby wombat from its mother for content. Another hid a turtle in his pants at TSA, and diners in China filmed themselves urinating into communal hot pot. We have the etiquette of teenagers and the resources of nations. Planes were a highlight reel of civilization's regression. Passengers punching, biting, opening exits over oceans, clogging toilets with rags and forcing returns. Airlines sued disruptive flyers for tens of thousands. And the pilot who turned back because he forgot his passport, the person you trust with 300 people's oxygen, decided paperwork was optional. It's all the same thread. Unlimited access plus zero impulse control. We can fly anywhere, map every path, monetize a sunset, and still manage to be the mess at the picnic. We travel to see the world and then behave as if the world is our hotel minibar. Take what you want, leave the mess, and complain when someone won't let you drink the minibar for free. In the age of global mobility, we didn't just export our culture, we exported our entitlement, edited it for social, and uploaded it with a terrible caption. We have everything except the basic manners to enjoy it without ruining it for everyone else.
Watching a foreign leader plucked from his bed like a TV plot twist is now apparently a weekend pastime at Mar-a-Lago. In 2026, with Donald Trump back in the White House after 2024, a president who spent holidays golfing and buying marble gave the thumbs up on a raid that had been planned for months, then streamed the whole thing to his private club while social media scrolled beside him. Delta Force went in at night, a carefully choreographed seizure after CIA operatives spent months cataloging Maduro's movements down to what he ate and which rooms he used. The president posted the after photo on his platform, the captured leader ferried through Guantanamo like luggage, then flown to a New York Air Guard base. The messy business of regime change arrived, wrapped in official jargon, cyber warfare, and a glossy propaganda image. This was marketed as precise, limited, and necessary. The reality was a full-scale operation. 150 aircraft, strikes to clear the sky, one helicopter hit but kept flying, executed while the commander-in-chief sampled dinner and watched as if flicking channels. Plans that were denied in public were acted on in secret, and senators later complained they had been misled. That mismatch between words and action is the point, not the bug. Calls about oil, talk of running a country, and offhand acceptance of boots on the ground show the goal isn't stability so much as control. The rhetoric of non-intervention that once energized a political base was shelved when the prize changed from principle to resources. The administration's solution for messy foreign politics looks eerily like the same old recipe: force, detention, and quick photo victories without planning for what comes after. Caracas went quiet. In the immediate aftermath, shops shuttered, and people walked through a city smelling of gunpowder. Back in Florida, the scene was surreal. a New Year's gala with Vanilla Ice on the calendar, while a foreign government was effectively seized. The spectacle feels deliberate. Make war look like theater, make power personal, and make consequences someone else's problem. There are already internal worries about blowback, legal questions, and the political costs of open intervention. Those concerns exist beside the administration's blithe confidence that history's messy lessons don't apply to this team. That mix of hubris and improvisation is never comforting. What happened in Caracas was not a spontaneous rupture. It was the outcome of months of secret work, public obfuscation, and a president who treats geopolitics like primetime entertainment. If politics keeps turning into private spectacle and international law into social media content, the country's next hard pivot, economic strain, refugee flows, regional instability, will feel less like surprise and more like the inevitable next episode.
This is adapted from a CNN article titled, Four Astronauts Will Soon Head Back to the Moon on a Flight Path Never Attempted Before. Four people will climb into a metal canister, hitch a ride on a rocket the size of a small apartment building, and commit themselves to 10 days of exquisite discomfort and high-stakes engineering so the rest of us can watch grainy photos of craters we already knew were there. That is progress, according to a civilization that invented both antibiotics and reality TV. Artemis II isn't a repeat of Apollo. It's a new riff. Same moon, different choreography, upgraded hardware, and a fresh batch of unknowns. The plan is to swing wide around the lunar neighbor, peek at parts of its face no human eye has seen, and test whether our newest gadgets will keep four bodies alive when they're 238,900 miles from the deli that stocks their favorite sandwich. We will send an organ chips into deep space to see how tiny pieces of ourselves behave when stripped of Earth's comforts and its magnetic umbrella. We will measure sleep, cognition, stress, immune responses. In short, we will study how glorified primates cope with extended absence from home. There's a comedic tension in all of this. On one hand, flawless ambition. On the other, heat shields that flake like bargain paint, and 45 minutes of being out of touch with anyone who might reassure you. Engineers call those moments loss of signal. Philosophers call them time to reconsider life choices. Politicians call them a national necessity because someone somewhere is building rockets too. Everyone calls them expensive. The mission is sold as a giant step toward a permanent lunar outpost and eventually Mars. It is also a very elaborate way to answer a simple human question. Can we leave the comfortable envelope Earth provides and still be ourselves? Can we thread enough science into a risky scenario to make it worth the headlines, the budgets, the contingency plans? The answer will probably be a mix of yes, no, and please file this operational anomaly. There is a kind of poetry in sending tissue chips to orbit while millions on Earth argue about who gets adequate healthcare, housing, or clean water. The moon trip will teach us about radiation and reentry heat, and whether Orion's paint wants to stay attached. It will also teach us something more awkward. That our grand narratives of destiny often run on a generator of practical problems. We learn by trial, and trial is expensive and sometimes combustible. Humans are both absurdly brave and absurdly hopeful. We build machines to leave the only home we know, and at the same time, bring along instruments that remind us how fragile we are. Maybe the point is to prove that a species of toolmakers can operate beyond its cradle. Maybe the point is to distract ourselves from the fact that the moon does not care whether we orbit it or not. Either way, four people will be circling a cold rock, taking notes about themselves, while the rest of us pretend the little flag and the neat science make it all feel intentional. If nothing else, Artemis II will give us new footage of a familiar neighbor and fresh data about what happens when we stop being comfortably shielded from the universe. We will applaud the engineering, debate the politics, and file the minor tragedies and triumphs under lessons learned. Then we'll plan the next mission, because curiosity is relentless and optimism is cheap to buy when sold in installments.
The headline is simple. The United States has decided to run Venezuela's oil like a corporate turnaround. The president has declared American firms will be invited in to spend billions fixing pipelines that haven't been touched in half a century, while Washington assumes temporary control of a country's biggest asset. The language is managerial. The act is occupation dressed as investment. Venezuela's 303 billion barrels read like a ledger entry, roughly a fifth of the world's reserves. But the barrels are not liquid gold waiting to flow. They are heavy, sour crude that chews up refineries and demands specialized equipment. They sit under rusted pipelines, gutted refineries, and an economy hollowed out by sanctions, corruption, and neglect. Bringing output back to even its former modest levels will cost tens of billions and take years, not press releases. That reality doesn't stop the sales pitch. Corporations are promised a revival, markets a calming narrative, and voters a short-term fantasy of cheaper gas. The math is uglier. Venezuela once pumped 3.5 million barrels a day, now barely a million. The fix is a multi-year, multi-billion dollar slog, and a perfect opportunity for profit extraction. While the state's institutions remain broken, and the people who pay the real price are invisible to the cameras. Markets may twitch at headlines, and traders will play the perception game, but perception can't rebuild pipelines overnight. Any win for consumers is likely to be slow, conditional, and paid for in political leverage, environmental damage, and a fresh wave of privatized control over a nation's core resource. Lower prices could even hollow out domestic investment, turning a supposed boon into a rearrangement of who gets paid. This is capitalism at full fever. Foreign governance rebranded as stabilization, public wealth repackaged as corporate opportunity, and the language of nation building repurposed as a business plan. The spectacle isn't about energy security or solidarity. It's about rerouting the last flows of natural wealth into the hands of those already collecting the tolls.